You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Everyone seems to agree that the cost of health care in the United States is too high, but there's little consensus about what to do about it. Elizabeth Rosenthal wrote about health care for two decades at the New York Times before she took over as editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News last year. In her latest book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back, she describes the role greed has played in ruining the industry. It's published by Penguin Random House, and I'm very pleased it has brought her back to our show. Good to see you again.
Thrilled to be here.
You've divided your book into two sections, the diagnosis and the cure. Is there much greed in the diagnosis part of healthcare?
Yes, I felt like it was really important for everyone to understand how we got to the system that nobody, literally nobody, likes anymore. So I wanted to understand myself, too, like, how did this profit motive kind of insidiously make its way into our healthcare system? And of course, something like that wouldn't have happened overnight. So what I try and trace in the first part of the book is how first one part of the health system starts looking for profit, and then another part starts looking. And I think what we see is a reversal or a total shift from the medical values of the health system that kind of were its guiding light maybe 30 years ago to today, when financial considerations are what drive our care.
And you're right, I'm quoting, one expert joked to me that if we relied on the current medical market to deal with polio, we would never have a polio vaccine. Instead, we would have iron lungs in seven colors and iPhone apps.
Yeah.
What incentives existed for doctors when Jonas Salk was developing a polio vaccine in the early 1950s?
Well, first of all, it was a really different mindset. You know, he said something like, well, of course I didn't patent it. Could you patent the sun? I mean, there was a notion that this was about public service. There was a notion that medical discoveries were for the good of mankind. And more importantly, perhaps, there was also the notion that you couldn't patent stuff like this, that things that were public good were not patentable. Now, of course, all of those things have changed. And universities, as we see now, I mean, you look at this CRISPR technology, the new technology, that's hugely important for patients. But we're not talking about what CRISPR can do for patients. We're talking far more about who owns the patent. Is it the Broad Institute or is it the UC system? That's where the big argument is, and that's crazy.
So the whole business of patents and the like started after 1953, after Jonas Salk?
Yeah.
How soon after 1953?
Well, everything happens so slowly so that you don't notice every bad thing as it's happening, you know. And a lot of the things start as a good idea. Of course, as technology advances, some of these things are truly revolutionary, truly new. You want them patented. But over time, that patent system gets perverted so that what we see now being patented are not those groundbreaking drugs only. It's the Me Too drugs, or I'm going to put this medicine into a new device. And that we get a patent for that, but that's not really a new medicine. That shouldn't deserve the same kind of patent protection.
And I just saw an article in yesterday's Times about a generic drug manufacturer who is raising the prices on generic drugs. I thought that generics were developed to lower prices.
Well, again, this is one of the myths that generic drugs are cheap. Well, they were cheap until someone realized, wait a second, if we have a market, let's see what the market will bear. And that's the defining price-setting mechanism of the U.S. now. What will the market bear?
In all areas of medical treatment, you're suggesting here.
Well, there are a lot of good people working in the medical system. There are a lot of companies trying to do the right thing. But, you know, there are people like Martin Shkreli, and who will see what the market will bear. There was the EpiPen episode. What were they doing? They were seeing what the market will bear. And P.S., those are just the ones we notice. I can tell you, as someone who's been following this, there are EpiPen episodes happening every day that we don't notice because maybe it's not a life-saving drug for kids. It's a drug that not so many people take, and it's not rising to $5,000 or $500. It's just rising from pennies to a dollar. But you know what? For people who are living on limited or fixed incomes, that's a big rise in price.
And in writing about the new economic rules that govern the medical market, you say a lifetime of treatment is preferable to a cure.
Right. Now, I have
generates
to
more money.
I have to point out that when I say that, that's if you're thinking about medicine from the finance point of view, that's clearly true. You don't want – the example I like to use is if there was a cure for type 1 diabetes, you would ruin a multi-billion dollar market. So who's going to invest in that kind of cure?
Well, is anyone in the medical profession speaking out about this shift in priorities?
Sure. I think you'll notice in the book some of the best sources and the best critics are our physicians, our researchers who want to do the right thing. But there's no business model always for doing the right thing in medicine. And so things that don't have a good business model, they're having a hard time doing.
So people go into medicine often because they want to help people. Is the problem with the next level up, the administrators, the people who run hospitals and other kinds of companies and run doctors' groups?
Well, I think there's no one problem, but in every area there's a problem with people who are concerned about finance coming into the system. And their question is, they apply the logic of business. Is it cost efficient? Is it is it revenue generating? And so a doctor, you know, think about it. One of the best techniques in medicine is called watchful waiting. Someone comes into the doctor's office with a hurt knee and they say, you know, before I take an X-ray or order an MRI, let's just wait 2 weeks and see what happens. There's no business model mm-hmm. for that, right? First of all, your finance guy is going to say, oh, your relative value units are down, that you didn't bill enough, you should be ordering a test. And the patient, you know, this is part of where I say patients are responsible too. Patients are likely to be disappointed if they're paying $300 for that visit. They want something done, right?
If I had high cholesterol and my doctor recommended putting me on one of the popular statins that deal with it, is that really the right course? If I were a cynic, might I suppose he was getting a kickback from a drug company? Because we've heard about those things.
I mean, I wouldn't. I think of your doctor as a partner, not as the enemy.
I like my doctor.
Yeah, I know. Most of us do like our doctors. So, you know, and the statins actually are one area where generics are pretty cheap now. So there's not a business model for overprescribing those. If it was an expensive cream for acne for one of your kids, I would wonder, why is he or she prescribing that? Because you're likely to go to the pharmacy and discover that little tube is retailing for something like $1,000, and you're going to have a big copay.
And in the old days, we just would have gotten some acne, over-the-counter acne cream, and it usually worked.
Well, one of the horrifying things I discovered in researching this book is that a lot of the things that are sold by prescription are actually just combinations of two over-the-counter ingredients, and they got a new patent for putting them together.
Or even one, because I have eye drops for pressure in one of my eyes, mm-hmm. and when I ran out while I was on vacation in France, I went into a pharmacy, I showed them it, and they pulled it out of a drawer, didn't ask me for a prescription.
Yeah. No, a lot of drugs that are
prescribed. It wasn't an opioid. There was no reason to worry about whether I was going to abuse it.
Right. And I think the decision for pharmaceutical firms in this country in taking something over the counter, meaning patients can buy it without a prescription, is more of a business decision than is it good for medicine? I mean, and that's a perfect example. Some of the drugs that in this country are by prescription are over-the-counter in other countries, or there's something that's called pharmacist dispensing, which we should do more of, frankly. Pharmacists have PhDs. They're smart people. We should allow them some limited ability to prescribe those routine things. In California, I believe, has changes for oral contraceptives. Now you can get those from a pharmacist without having to go to a doctor, which is another $300 to get the prescription.
My guest is Elizabeth Rosenthal, whose latest book is An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Another of the rules you cite here is there's money to be made in billing for anything and everything. How can patients, especially ones who are ill, make sure that they aren't being billed for unnecessary procedures or lab tests?
Well, there are things you can do. I mean, first of all, when I say anything and everything, I mean like when you're in the hospital, if someone is walking you to the bathroom after surgery, you have to think, and this is a terrible burden to put on patients, whoa, this may be billed as a physical therapy visit.
Just going to the bathroom.
Yeah, because, you know, they're going to check off a box and it will say on your final bill, physical therapy. Or when you're lying there in the recovery room, or when you have those little prongs with oxygen in your nose, that's being billed by 15-minute segments. I mean, you're racking up the bucks there.
And you write that every patient should ask, is there a concierge fee? What's a concierge fee?
It's something we see having come into primary care practices largely, where a physician will do what your physician has always done, but say, you have to become a member of my practice. So there'll be a yearly fee, and sometimes they can be pretty high, you know, $1,000, $2,000, $3,000. And they'll offer you enhanced service. You know, I'm a better doctor than most, or I'll come see you in the hospital, or I'll answer your calls, you know, promptly. And part of me, as a physician, as someone who trained as a physician, as someone whose dad was a physician, recoils at this because, really, this is what doctors do. So you have to pay them extra to answer your calls. I mean, in fairness to the physicians, what they're faced with is the insurers, who are big behemoths, are negotiating lower and lower rates for what they do. So they feel like, hey, I'm being screwed here. I have to fight back and find other ways to recoup income. But everyone's playing that game, trying to get their income back. And, you know, poor patients, we're kind of stuck in the middle. But there is stuff you can do.
When I start seeing a doctor, is it important to know what hospital he or she is affiliated with?
Well, that was always the case. But I think now more than ever, when you start with a new practice, you have to ask lots of questions. First of all, is there a concierge fee? Because I've heard from a lot of patients that they signed up with a doctor and then later said, oh, you haven't paid the concierge fee. And they were like, what? And once they have a relationship, it's awkward and you feel odd. You should ask also, is your practice owned by a hospital? More and more of doctors' practices are now bought by hospitals. And what that means for you in your bills is that you're going to be charged a hospital facility fee. So I had one patient who had some lung problems, and she'd repeatedly gotten chest x-rays at her doctor's office. Suddenly she got a bill for that same chest x-ray in that same office, and the price was five times as much because it was now in the hospital, rebranded as the hospital. It was the same place, and there was this big facility fee. So you got to be on your guard, and it's a terrible burden to put on patients, but that's our reality at the moment.
And you're right about drive-by doctors. Who are they?
Yeah, that's more in the hospital. And again,
so now you're in the hospital because your doctor is now his office has been bought by the hospital. Well, that's in the best interest of the doctor because the doctor gets some money when he or she is bought?
No, I think not that directly. And doctors were always affiliated with hospitals, and there's a benefit in that. They know the hospital, they know the nurses. But what drive-by doctoring is when you're lying in the hospital bed and suddenly a doctor comes up and says, hi, I'm Dr. X, I'm a dermatologist, I'm going to look at your skin rash. And I think it behooves you at that point to say, gee, that skin rash has been there for the last year. No, thank you. Because a doctor doing a consultation in the hospital is going to be charging you 5-10 times as much as you would in a doctor's office. And P.S., your doctor has probably looked at that rash already. So sometimes those drive-by doctors have been requested by the primary team. But that doesn't make it all right. And you have the right, and this is part of why I wrote the book, is to make patients understand, to change their relationship with medicine, to say, no thanks, I don't want that. No thanks, I don't need that. My doctor's already seen that. And even if you're not paying directly out of pocket, which we aren't in hospitals generally, when people say, gee, why are premiums going up? It's because those bills are so exorbitantly overpriced that what insurers who want to guard their profits do is the next year they say, we're going to increase your premiums, we're going to increase your copays, increase your deductibles. Those high prices, even if you're not paying them today, will come back to bite you tomorrow.
I'm speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, who is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News after 22 years as a reporter and correspondent, senior writer at the New York Times, in which she wrote about health issues, among other things. Also spent some time covering China in Beijing. Her book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back, is published by Penguin Press. Stay with us for more. Next Thursday, April 20th at noon, we will be broadcasting live on stage at the Green Space, and we're sure you're going to want to be there because we have put together an amazing lineup of guests, including Patti LuPone, Christine Ebersole, Kelly O'Hara, Bill Irwin, Anthony Bourdain, Jeremiah Tower. Believe me, you do not want to miss this show. So for more information, you can go to our show page at wmyc.org/lopate, or if you want to buy tickets, visit wmyc.org/thegreenspace. You're listening to WMIC and wmyc.org. We're back with Elizabeth Rosenthal, whose latest book is An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back, published by Penguin Press. Hospitals have been consolidating in recent years, and in some cases, they have monopolies in communities. How important is that? Does it improve the medical care that we get?
No, not at all. You know, the consolidation trend started in the 90s, and at that point it was a good idea because there were efficiencies. Again, it's the business narrative comes in. It's more
you have
efficient.
An MRI machine, I don't now, right. We can share it.
Right. Well, even more than that, they both want an MRI machine because there's money to be made with MRIs. But, you know, we don't have to order laundry separately. Maybe I've got the best heart surgeon, you have the best, you know, neurosurgeon, so we'll join forces. So it made sense. But the problem is the consolidation has progressed to a point now where it's about cornering a market. That's the key effect of consolidation. All the recent studies have shown increased consolidation in hospitals leads to higher prices, not better results.
But aren't hospitals, most hospitals anyway, classified as nonprofits?
Yes, they are classified as nonprofits, although I think that's a coming battle because I think a lot of them don't act like nonprofits, and they certainly don't look like nonprofits. I mean, you go and you see the marble lobbies and the fountains. It makes me a little nuts when people say, oh, I love this hospital. There's free coffee. Well, we're all paying for that. And so I suggest everyone go find the 990 tax form of their local hospital and look at what their operating surplus is. They may not be profitable, but they have huge operating surpluses, which I'm not quite sure what the difference is. But as someone said to me, we don't think of Apple as a nonprofit, even though it gives away some free computers. So I think these are lucrative machines. They pay high salaries to their executives, far higher. The highest paid nonprofit executive in most cities is going to be the CEO of the hospital.
You tell the story of Providence Portland Medical Center, a Northwest hospital system that was founded by nuns, and its CEO earned over $4 million.
Yeah, and we see this commonly. You know, they've kept the narrative of healing and health care.
Well, it was a
Catholic
charity. How did it become transformed into one of the nation's largest nonprofit hospital systems with revenue of $14 billion in 2015?
Yeah, well, you see this with I mean, a lot of little hospitals were started by a local businessman. And basically, again, the finance people come in, they see efficiencies, meaning in terms of business, we could make more money. They come in, literally business consultants come in from some of the big consultants like Deloitte and say, hey, you guys, you know, you could bill a lot more, but for that same exact service, here are some money-making opportunities. And that becomes the driving force. And I have to say, physicians mostly hate that, you know, because they don't want to be told, you have to do these four things so we can bill for a level four visit. They want to do what they think is right for their patient.
What happened to the nuns?
Some of them are still on the, well, I think they're called sponsors now at Providence, but they're still around. And that's what particularly bothers me. these hospitals keep the aura. Most hospitals have, many of them in cities have religious names. They've kept the aura of, you know, Mother Teresa, and, as I say, kind of adopted the practices of Goldman Sachs. And that's a really uncomfortable problem for me.
Patients are also supposed to ask if lab tests and x-rays will be done in network, right, or whether the anesthesiologist will be part of the in-network expense. Aren't doctors obligated to send you in-network?
No, and I think one of the things that was most distressing and amusing to me is looking at how the pledges of the American College of Surgeons and the American Medical Association changed. So originally they were like, without regard to a patient's ability to pay. And those clauses all got taken out in the late 90s, early 2000s. So now what we see is you go to a in-network hospital because you know that you'll be vulnerable for expensive charges if you don't. And guess what? The hospital may be in-network, but the emergency room doctor isn't in-network. Or you get a colonoscopy and you go to an in-network doctor, and the anesthesiologist is out of network. But those things you can do something about. That's really important for patients to know. You always say to your doctor, as I say to mine now, because now my antenna are up, you want to send off some blood tests? Great. But you have to send it to these three labs, which are in my network. When I go into a hospital, I add to that consent form, the financial willingness to pay. So long as the providers are in network, I'm going to throw it back on them because I did everything I could do to stay in network, and they tricked me.
But even in network, the price of a colonoscopy, for example, can vary between $1,000 and $3,000. Yep. Would the $3,000 colonoscopy be all that different from the $1,000 one?
Likely not different at all. I mean, you could say that even more for MRI scans, which could vary by even more than that, and it's the same exact machine. So I think what we have to ask of our physicians, I mean, first of all, as a patient, there's something you can do. You can look up on tools like Fair Health or Clear Health Costs. What are the average costs of a colonoscopy in my neighborhood, and use that as a yardstick. Am I being bilked or not? But more than that, I think we should ask our physicians to know about these price variations. They know which centers they trust for colonoscopies. And I think what my ask for physicians is to say, okay, send me to the one you know does a good job and has the lowest price or a reasonable price, and tell the guy who's charging $3,000 you'd be lucky for, $10,000 for a colonoscopy, I'm not sending patients to you anymore because this is not right. This is not good for my patients. So that's my ask to our physician partners.
My guest is Elizabeth Rosenthal. Her latest book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back, published by Penguin. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A listener, Stuart from Manhattan, asked why certain medications cost so much more if they're bought through insurance copayments than if you buy them for yourself at Costco. he mentions Nexium is over double as much when he buys it, you would have thought, the more expensive way.
Right. And the thing is, because pharmacies set their prices for some of these drugs. They're like $5 scripts as a way to get you in the door. I mean, this is a really dysfunctional market. So they may be offering you lower than list price to get you in the door so you'll buy other stuff at the pharmacy. Conversely, insurers, they may not be bargaining for a very good rate for you. They don't, you know, they may not care. They may, part of the deal they do on drugs with a pharmacy benefit manager may be, we're going to charge you more for Nexium and less for something else. And we're kind of captive. A lot of pharmacies, if you have insurance, won't let you buy over the counter that way. And I've had a pharmacist say to me, oh, you have insurance, you have to buy it with your insurance. That's not true.
But Express Scripts will send me a nasty little note if they discover I bought something at the local CVS.
Absolutely. I mean, everyone is trying to keep you in their financial purview. And that's where we have to stand up and say, I'm not going to take it anymore. You know, enough.
You write about another concept unique to American medicine called sticky pricing. What's that?
This is makes economists laugh. normally we think of a market as bringing prices down, right? Once there are a lot of competitors, they compete, and then the price decreases. The exact opposite happens in some parts of American medicine. So the classic example of this is multiple sclerosis drugs, you know, a very serious progressive disease that new drugs treat miraculously. I mean, it really has been wonderful for people with this disease. But each time a new drug comes in, and they're all more or less equivalent, and it comes in at a higher price, and all the others bounce up to that price. So it's this, you know, the latest, most expensive price that someone has gotten away with becomes the sticky price, and everyone says, gee, if that pharma company got away with it, then we should too. And so we've seen over time these prices go up to a point where they're now literally three times as much as in other countries. And doctors from other countries look at us and go, why are you guys paying this? There's no reason.
President Trump and many members of his party campaigned to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, but everyone agrees that there are problems, although there are problems with the current system. Isn't it more popular now than ever before?
Well, the Affordable Care Act did some really important things. It gave people with pre-existing conditions a right to insurance at a reasonable rate. No one has solved that on the GOP side, I think, at the moment. It created the narrative that healthcare is something that government should help people with, and 20 million more people have insurance now. So I don't know how you're going to – I mean, and clearly the ACA had its flaws. It had things that needed fixing. But in the end, I go with President Obama's final statement, which was, yeah, fine, if these guys have something that's better, that provides Americans with more affordable, more accessible healthcare, so be it. But I haven't seen it yet, and it's a hard Rubik's Cube to fix.
And, of course, we've already gotten a question from one of our listeners, Richard from Manhattan, who asked, wouldn't a single-payer system offer relief from rising costs? It's the system that you find in most other countries. But Dwight Eisenhower, I think, was the first person to say no. He saw that as creeping socialism.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what I like to point out, and I do in the last part of the book, is there are lots of different ways to solve the healthcare cost problem, but you can't do it by allowing the free market to run its course. So, yes, many countries have used single payer in a very effective way. Single payer means the government generally pays for healthcare. But an important component of that, which we have shied away from to our detriment, is some kind of price regulation, you know, and every single payer system regulates price in some way. Now, that doesn't have to be the government swooping in and saying, we're only going to pay you this or that. So in some countries, it's a negotiation between the government, physicians, and insurers to agree on a price in the way we do on a encounter-by-encounter-by-encounter basis. So national pricing would certainly help. Both Republicans and the Democrats have endorsed the idea at some level that Medicare should be allowed to negotiate drug prices, which would certainly make a difference. There are bipartisan bills to allow imports, which would make a difference. Working against all those things is that the hospital and the pharma industry and the insurance industry lobby heavily to prevent that kind of thing.
So let's talk about Medicare. Who sets the cost of procedures for Medicare, and who determines if a procedure is actually necessary?
Well, Medicare is essentially a single-payer system mm-hmm. for people over 65 and people who are disabled. There's an agency that sets prices for Medicare. It decides what it will cover. It makes very, I'd like to say, clear rules about what it will and won't cover. But what you see is the response of providers, especially those with the kind of good finance, creative venture capital backing, will say, okay, Medicare says a surgeon has to be there for the crucial part of an operation. What does crucial part mean? So they game those Medicare metrics in a way that, again, is very bad for patients but good for profits.
Tom Price, who is a former representative, now leads the Department of Health and Human Services, has argued that, quote, nothing has had a greater negative effect on the delivery of health care than the federal government's intrusion into medicine through Medicare.
Well, I know Dr. Price feels that, and I think all I can say is the responses I get from patients is people talk about the promised land of Medicare because they no longer have to go through this this incredible angst about how much they're going to have to pay. I also hear from more and more physicians who say, fine, let's go to Medicare for All, single-payer system. That includes surgeons. That includes primary care.
Although not all doctors will take Medicare.
Not all doctors will take Medicare.
And it is appropriate that his name is Price.
Well, yes, but I would note the, you know, the American Medical Association, the American Medical Students Association has endorsed a single-payer system. So younger doctors, the ones coming up from the system, may not be as hostile towards the idea as we see from some of the older physicians.
Now, we don't have much time. I was going to ask you also about some of the medical devices, such as artificial hips and knees. Some people think that they're in many cases, they're given to people who don't really need them. But is there something that you feel we should get in here before we go?
Well, two things. I think it's important to say that single payer isn't the only answer. There are other countries that work with a much more market-based system, but they always have some way to control price and cost. And if we don't do that, I don't think any plan, whether it's the ACA or the some Republican version, will make our system work because we are paying prices that are exorbitant and we haven't controlled those. So that's a crucial take home, I think, from the book. In terms of hip and knee replacements, I love talking about them because they are life changing for people, right? They make a huge difference. But the price of a hip and knee replacement can vary from $30,000 to $150,000, depending on your hospital. One thing that was coming into play in the Medicare world is something called bundle payments, where Medicare would say, we're going to give you $35,000 for this procedure, hospital and doctors, and you figure out how you want to divvy up that pot. Dr. Price is very opposed and has canceled or postponed the implementation of that notion. That notion has worked very well for some insurers who've tried it, and it protects patients from suddenly opening a bill and seeing, especially at this time of rising copays and deductibles, of opening a bill for a $100,000 hip replacement and seeing your patient responsibility is $10,000.
And not knowing what the codes all mean either.
Oh, no. I mean, that's yet another discussion of, you know, the best way to deliver patients bills that they're going to pay is to deliver them in a language they don't understand with a threat of being sent to collection if you don't.
Elizabeth Rosenthal, excuse me, her latest book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. It's published by Penguin Press. It's always a pleasure having you on our show.
Thanks. Love being here.